Welcome to Brookings. My name is Mauricio Cárdenas, and I'm a senior fellow here at the director of the Latin America Initiative. We're delighted to host today an event on the macroeconomic outlook for Latin America and the Caribbean. We are also very happy to have two of the leading reports on this topic to be discussed. One, the report that is put together by the Inter-American Development Bank, led by Ernesto Talvi and Alejandro Izquierdo, and the other, the report that is also biannual and put together by the IMF, the Regional Economic Outlook, led by Nicolas Eiz Aguirre and Steve Phillips. Today's event will be moderated by Carol Graham. Carol is a senior fellow here at the Brookings Institution, very well known to many of you, a leading scholar in the topic of the economics of happiness. So I really hope that the news that we're going to hear today are good news, and they seem so, anyway, as Latin America is doing relatively well in the macroeconomic front. So without further ado, let me welcome Carol, who is going to be moderating today's event. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mauricio. And indeed, I have the happy pleasure of introducing both these reports and the speakers. And they are reports with good news, where Latin America has better news than the United States. So it's a nice changing of the tides. In fact, we had another wonderful presentation here on Monday by Nora Lustig and another group of scholars telling also a positive story about Latin America, about inequality declining somewhat. And so let's keep the good news rolling here. I have the unhappy task, though, of moderating a rather complicated panel with two reports and two sets of panelists. So I'm going to do my best to keep us on time, and I have even an especially large watch to do so. So I suppose I'm in charge here. So first of all, we're going to discuss the IDB report, the aftermath of the crisis, policy lessons and challenges ahead for Latin America and the Caribbean. And that's going to be presented by Ernesto Talvi and Alejandro Izquierdo, followed by a brief discussion. Then we'll switch over and do the IMF report. Alejandro Izquierdo is currently a principal economist at the Research Department of the Inter-American Development Bank and previously worked in the World Bank, and he's taught in several Latin American universities. He has a PhD in economics from the University of Maryland and undergraduate degrees and master's degrees from the Instituto Torquato di Tella in Argentina and the Universidad de Buenos Aires. Ernesto Talvi is currently the executive director of CERES, Center for the Study of Economic and Social Affairs in Uruguay, and he's also a permanent advisor to the chief economist of the Inter-American Development Bank and is well known to many of you here in Washington. So with no further ado, I'll turn it over to Alejandro and Ernesto, and then we'll start a discussion after their presentation.
Well, thanks a lot for the invitation. I want to thank Mauricio and Stephen Magnuson for all the organization and the participation in this event. It's a pleasure to be here. So much so that Argentina is right now playing a game, and I decided to come here. And I'm from Argentina. All right. So I'll be presenting the macro report today together with Ernesto. This is joint work by the research department coordinated by us. And the presentation today is going to have two sections. The first section is going to be an outlook and some macro policy challenges for the region. And the second section will be a part of the report that contributes to understanding the resilience of Latin America during the global crisis and how much the international financial architecture had a game to play in this crisis. So for a long time now at IDB, we have been focusing based on the tradition that Guillermo Calvo and Carmen Reinhart and Leo Lederman in 1992 started with the impact of external factors in economic activity. We've built a framework that just by using a key set of variables, basically industrial production in the G7, the terms of trade, UST bond yields, and the high yield spreads, those variables when you put them together in a formal econometric model, account for about 60% of the variance of output. So that has been our key element, our workhorse for forecasting or for building up scenarios for the region. So as you can see in this graph here, just by fitting in the growth of industrial countries and China, commodity prices, and international financial conditions into a into this estimated model, we can account pretty well for the growth behavior of the region. So here you have the green line being the observed growth rates and the red line being our estimates based on external factors. So with this framework, we take a look now at what happened to this inputs for our growth scenarios in 2010 compared to 2009 to understand where we are. And what we see is that there has been a rebound in growth in industrial countries. China is now growing faster, and commodity prices have recovered at least to early 2007 levels. If you look at financial variables, you see that sovereign bond spreads have declined significantly after the crisis, and bond prices recovered to pre-crisis levels as well. So it should come as no surprise when we look at the behavior, economic activity, and the forecasts, the growth forecasts for the seven largest Latin American economies, that there is a rebound of about 6% percentage points in growth from like 1.7% contraction in 2009 to about 4.1% increase in GDP expected for 2010. Now, this is where we stand, and the report aims to build alternative scenarios in order to understand possible outcomes for the region. And we, at this point, and in the report, specifically bar any catastrophic or panic scenarios. We do not assume that the European crisis is going to get messier than it has so far. I will mention something at the end of my presentation. But basically, the report builds two scenarios, one which is a positive scenario of global demand rebalancing. In this scenario, the U.S. Starts a deleveraging process, which can be seen by the fact that the current account deficit has been narrowing. And this deleveraging process with a fall in demand in the U.S. is accompanied by an increase in demand in the rest of the world, basically the emerging world and China. And that leads to higher commodity prices because China is basically a strong consumer of commodities. And the fact that still excess world savings remain, then we expect in this case to have high capital inflows and declining spreads. So that's the first positive or rosy scenario, if you want. And then we construct an alternative scenario where the U.S. Again goes through the deleveraging process, but that's not accompanied by an increase in demand in the rest of the world. So commodity prices do not keep on increasing as in the first scenario. And part of the excess world savings, since there's going to be lower growth in the rest of the world, mean that there will be declining capital inflows to emerging markets and maybe higher spreads. So to summarize, you have these two scenarios depicted here in terms of world growth, commodity prices, and international financial conditions. We see the diverging paths for growth in G7 and China. This is the positive scenario. This is the alternative scenario. We see commodity prices increasing in the first scenario where they stall in the second scenario. And again, bond spreads remaining at low levels in the first scenario and an increase in spreads in the second scenario. How does that translate into our expected growth paths for each of these scenarios? Well, in the first scenario, the region returns to about a growth rate of about 6%, which is pretty much the same as their pre-crisis growth rates, whereas in the second scenario, with the shrinking world savings and lower growth, we would be reaching an average of about 3.4% growth in the period 2011 to 2014. So what you see is these two possible scenarios that we construct and we discuss in much more detail in the report. These two scenarios have different implications in terms of policy, as you can imagine. I mean, the first scenario would be a scenario of bonanza, which I'm not going to discuss in detail here. What I'm going to make the argument is that to the extent that risk aversion elements remain within policymakers and those elements are stronger than political economy elements, then the region should focus on managing a short-run bonanza, planning perhaps for a slowdown in growth ahead. So in that scenario, the report recommends rebuilding optimal levels of international reserves throughout the bonanza, saving for a rainy day, and controlling inflation to avoid excessive real exchange rate appreciation. And the policies in that case would be reserve accumulation, a reprofiling of debt maturities, and a fluent relationship with the IMF and the MDBs, and Ernesto has a lot more to say on this later on. Avoid large expenditure growth, and work with a tighter fiscal and credit policy, and perhaps sterilize intervention. So these are the scenarios that we have in the report. Now, we cannot ignore the fact that the European crisis is evolving every day and for now has been contained, but there are still many elements to be solved, and it's not an easy issue because it involves collective decisions which may be difficult, and they have proved difficult to contain. So in this other scenario, which is not in the report, but we did it out of curiosity, we said, okay, let's go back to the Lehman crisis levels of external variables, basically returning to spreads about 900 basis points as they were at the time of the Lehman crisis in the region, then also taking a fall in commodity prices of the same amount that took place, a proportional amount that took place by the time of the Lehman crisis, and also a slowdown in economic activity in the industrialized world. When you feed those inputs to our model, what you see is that in this particular case, growth would be on average about 0.6% of GDP for the same period I was discussing before. So there would be a substantial slowdown of growth in the region. Now, whether this scenario is going to materialize or not depends on several events. What we would suggest is that in this particular, if we were to go into this mode, then the policies that should be addressed can be traced to our last year's report, where we focused on the policies necessary for a crisis mode situation, and that incorporates a lot of systemic elements, and this is why Ernesto is going to tackle with the next section.
Mauricio, thank you so much for the invitation. Thank you, Stephen, for the organization. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm from Uruguay, so no crowding out. We won yesterday 3-0. So one of the most intriguing puzzles during the Lehman crisis episode was the fact that in spite of the global nature of the crisis, MB spreads for emerging markets never reached the levels that it had reached during the Russian LTCM crisis, that was a more localized and less widespread crisis. So this is the puzzle we wanted to address. What happened? I mean, we should have expected a much larger impact given the global nature of the crisis, and any measure of financial shocks or real shocks suggests that actually the shock was much larger this time around than it was during the Russian crisis. So one possible explanation is that emerging countries, and this is done for emerging countries as a whole, and I'll go back to Latin America in a minute, had much better fundamentals this time around than they had prior to the Russian LTCM crisis. So in order to test for that, and we did a lot of tests, essentially we came up with the credit ratings as a very reasonable proxy of fundamentals, including in the fundamentals the liquidity that countries do have on their own buildup of liquidity or reserves. And in fact, when we look at credit ratings, what we see is that the pre-Lehman crisis credit ratings of fundamentals were better than and closer to investment grade than they were prior to the Russian crisis. So what we did is we created two groups of countries during the Lehman crisis, a group with a BB plus ratings, which were the pre-Lehman crisis fundamentals, and an alternative group or control group with the pre-Russian crisis fundamentals. And what we expected is that not only the countries with the worst fundamentals were to perform worse than they did during the during the Lehman crisis, which in fact they did. As you can see here, the red line is the BB plus, the green line is the BB credit rating countries during the Lehman crisis. But since the shock this time around was larger, we were expecting these countries to perform worse than what BB countries did during the Russian crisis. And in fact, what we found is that still during the Russian crisis, even controlling for fundamentals, the shock was larger. So basically, fundamentals, although important, as we see, are not telling us the whole story. So a second competing explanation has to do with the fact that this time around, given the global nature of the crisis and the readiness of the international community to provide liquidity support to emerging markets early on, in a timely, unconditional, preventive, and sizable way, because this was something innovative during this crisis. I mean, during the Russian crisis, the aid from the international community was slow-moving, conditional, curative rather than preventive, and much smaller in magnitude. This predisposition of the international community to provide or to play the role of international lender of last resort was seen early on. As early as April 2008, Japan arranged swap agreements with Indonesia, 2 months later with India. When the Lehman crisis exploded, the Fed immediately offered swap lines to Brazil, Korea, Mexico, and Singapore. The IMF launched the short-term liquidity facility. Many voices in academia and in the policy world were calling for a recycling of some of the flight capital back into emerging markets to prevent liquidity crisis or financial distress in these countries. So the markets actually could have reasonably expected that through these actions that what eventually happened in April 2009, which was the decision by the G20 to recapitalize in a very substantial way the international organizations, in particular the IMF, and with the launching of the flexible credit line, which essentially created the means through which these resources could be channeled unconditionally and in a very timely way and in sizable amounts to fundamentally sound emerging economies. So what we did is say, well, let's see if there is something into this lender of last resort aspect of the crisis that could have made the difference this time around. So what we did is we created a group of countries that could reasonably not have been expected to have access to these lender of last resort facilities. How did we define objectively this group? Through any of these three conditions. No Article 4 consultation with the IMF for at least 2 years, which could be an indication that there are some problems in the relationship. A country that is in arrears with the IMF or in default with bond holders. Any of these conditions would indicate that probably these countries would not have obtained access to lender of last resort facilities being launched during the crisis. So once we've identified these countries, we looked at the average credit rating of these countries and we constructed a control group that had the same credit rating as these, no access to lender of last resort facility countries, the same credit rating, but with access to lender of last resort facilities. And the results are really striking. When we look at the access countries, spreads went up by approximately 800 points. These are very low credit rating countries. But the no access countries, which is the orange line, the spreads went up by 1,600 points. And in fact, and more importantly, they went up by more than the countries with the same credit ratings during the Russian crisis. So this is very interesting because once we control for both fundamentals and the access to international lender of last resort facilities that were essentially absent during the Russian crisis, then the impact on spreads is larger in this crisis, the Lehman crisis, than it was during the Russian LTCM crisis, which was exactly what we were expecting, given that this crisis was a lot larger in magnitude. And in fact, we did this formally, and you can find it in the report, by regressing the change in spreads in the 60-day window, 15 days prior to the Lehman crisis, and 40 days following the Lehman crisis, which was the apex of the U.S. high yield spreads and the moment of more tension during the crisis. And what we find is that the fundamentals as proxied here by credit ratings and many alternative measures that you can see in the econometric work and the access, the binary variable access, no access to liquidity facilities by the international community are both very, very relevant. Now, quantitatively, and this is very important, the exercise we perform is now that we have a model of the spread changes, what spread changes should we had expected to occur had Latin American countries had the credit ratings that they had prior to the Russian crisis and no access to lender of last resort facilities, which was essentially the environment during the Russian crisis. And we would have predicted an increase in spreads of 1,300 points. However, the observed increase was only 500 points. And when we split the difference between fundamentals, the role of stronger fundamentals and access to international lender of last resort facilities, the second aspect is quantitatively, during this accident, more important than actually the strength of fundamentals. Now, this should come as no surprise to Guillermo Calvo, and I'm glad that he's here, because after the Russian crisis, he immediately suggested that this was a systemic crisis that required systemic solutions and proposed the creation of an emerging market fund. This is conceptually, what happened is very akin to that. And essentially, our empirical work suggests that it worked. And it worked big time. Now, I'll be there, Carol. This is very important to make clear. When we present this, people react saying, well, I mean, we've been doing all the homework, putting our fundamentals right, and now you're telling us that fundamentals did not matter. It's important to understand the nature of the experiment. And I like to compare it with a very severe accident, car accident. You're being hit by a truck. Then if you smoke or if you don't smoke, if you exercise or you don't exercise, probably it's going to make a little bit of a difference whether you survive or you don't survive the accident because you're physically stronger. But In the instance of such an accident, the most important thing is how quickly the ambulance is going to come to the scene and take you back to the emergency room. Not whether you smoke or you don't smoke, whether you... Now, smoking, exercising is very important for longevity. So it's very important for very meaningful things, but it's not necessarily the most relevant factor when you are in the middle of a huge accident. Then the ambulance, and the ambulance to us was the international, the support by the international community.
Huh?
Well, it's not irrelevant, Nicolas. It's not irrelevant, but it's quantitatively much less important than the ambulance. Let me skip so I can go to the last two slides and comply with Carol's stringent rules. So to us in Latin America, and I think for emerging markets, the architecture that it's somehow in an ad hoc form and in response to a crisis was created, which to us had these ingredients. I mean, at the multilateral level, we had these ex-ante, automatic, very timely and sizable assistance that actually worked. But it was only made available to countries with sound fundamentals. And to us, going forward, sound fundamentals should mean more regime-based rather than concrete and specific targets. And regime-based can be the jure with rules, fiscal rules a la Chile, for example, but they also could be de facto. I mean, many rules are there because they happen to be enacted or practiced for many, many years, and they create a track record of performance, even if it's not actually ingrained in the law. And this two ingredients, together with the endowing the IMF and the MDBs with the other resources for the task, constitute what we like to call a long-term stability pact between the international community and emerging countries that provide lender of last resort facilities for these countries and at the same time create the incentives to promote sound policies in order to be able to access ex ante these facilities. So this is, and just to close to me and to Alejandro, very, very relevant and may have far-reaching implications for emerging markets because they will reduce the probability of disruptive liquidity crisis, of contagion. Therefore, they may improve substantially the long-term prospects of our countries as disruptive liquidity crises diminish their incidence and incentives for good policies are enacted. Now, these insurance mechanisms will also create problems in the sense that the reallocation of world capital in favor of EMs can actually create other problems. And just in closing, one caveat that I think the international or note of caution, the international community should be prepared for. According to this evidence, the pool of liquidity that was made available to emerging economies was very important in preventing financial distress and allowing for countercyclical policies. Now, if the European crisis gets worse and the IMF is going to start committing a lot of resources in that crisis, I mean, let us pay attention to the fact that that may crowd out resources that were initially thought for emerging economies, and that if we enter into panic mode at a certain point during the European crisis, I mean, hopefully the international community will realize that these resources for emerging markets have to be there. And it eventually may require, at least transitorily, increasing even more the resources that the IMF and the MDBs have at their disposal. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ernesto and Alejandro, for a wonderful presentation and a really good report. We're going to turn now to the presentation of the IMF report and then bunch the questions for both. So we have Nicolás Aguirre and Steve Phillips presenting the Western Hemisphere, taking advantage of tailwinds. Nicolás Aguirre is director of the Western Hemisphere Department at the Fund, and prior to that was Minister of Finance of Chile. He's also been professor of economics at the University of Chile and director of economic studies at the Central Bank there, among other things. Steve Phillips is chief of regional studies at the International Monetary Fund, and he's been there since 1991 when he received his PhD in economics from the University of California at Berkeley. And he's written on issues pertaining to IMF-supported economic programs, in particular with regard to moral hazard, the Asian crisis, and the accuracy of program forecasts. So with no further ado, I'll turn it over to the two of you, and then after that we'll have all four presenters up here at the podium, and we can have questions and answers.
Thanks, Carolyn. Thanks, Stephen, and everyone for organizing this and inviting us. I think Nicolás and I will take 10 minutes each. The good news is I think that we agree on most points with our IDB colleagues. So I'll just try to briefly go through a few of the key messages from our reports and maybe emphasize a few subtle differences. And Nicolás will close then with some bigger picture remarks on the region, but also on the global context and the challenges going forward. Before the question thing, I'd say the one nuance to mention that I think we might differ on a bit is, and it's just a nuance, is that how important the fundamentals were relative to the improvement in the lender of last resort facility. I mean, we certainly welcome the message. It's very clear that the improvement in the international community's attitude with more access, that was key difference. I just have one concern, is that maybe the fundamentals improvement that occurred in our region might have been a little bit understated. In particular, say, if the credit agencies is a perfectly fine thing to look at. But I wonder if the credit agencies were getting it right in 1997 or 1998, whether the improvement from BB to BB plus really reflects all the improvements. My own take is just an intuition, and I'll pass over it quickly, is that the credit agencies weren't looking hard enough at things like floating exchange rates, currency mismatches, the Greenspan-Guidotti rule. The information wasn't even available well enough for rating agencies if they look at a country like Korea and know what its foreign exchange position was. So I think basically there might be a mismeasurement of the improvement that's happened in countries' fundamentals around the world, and especially in regime changes in Latin America. But it's just a thought to go on with. I brought with us just a few slides on how we – I need – Stephen, how do I move to our presentation? I like theirs, but I need ours. Press escape again. Sorry, it's at the bottom of the page, right? Yeah, but I'm older than I look. Okay. So my wife says. Okay, here we are. That was it. That was this one right there.
There you go. And then hold on, let me get it to slideshow.
All right. Thanks a lot. Okay. The global recovery we see in 2010 is what we're calling a multi-speed. That's multi-speed around the world, with contractions still in some parts of Europe, and also in Venezuela, so within our region as well. But basically, we've got a multi-speed recovery and unbalanced global recovery going on. And within Latin America, we've got countries such as Brazil and Peru, Uruguay growing very fast. In fact, they were growing quite fast before the crisis. So there's quite a bit of divergence within our region. One thing is, although the global recovery has been mixed, and not the strongest, not the full rebound that you'd like to see, a V-shaped recovery in, say, the U.S., it's been strong enough to push commodity prices back to what are very high levels still. And this still holds even with the developments in the last 6 weeks. That's, I think, going to be an important message, is that we don't really see what's happened in Europe and in the global economy, the global financial markets, in the last 6 weeks, 2 months, as really changing what's most important for our region, is that still it's a very favorable external environment for our region in two particular areas. Easy external financing conditions, still, I'll make that case, and historically high commodity prices, which are good for most of our, well, for our bigger countries especially. This is to basically to make the case that easy external financing conditions are here and are continuing. This this chart basically compares bond spreads around the world. That's the overall MBIG. In our Latin American five countries, LA five. So these are the sort of the financially integrated countries, the countries with good credit ratings. It's basically the LA seven that you were mentioning, minus Argentina and Venezuela. We could have Uruguay in there, but it's it happens not to be in this particular chart. The message here is that it wasn't that so long ago, in mid-2007, that spreads were at historic lows. And what was driving that was partly fundamentals, but this was around the world. This was mainly global risk aversion, which is proxied by this VIX measure, the one in the green bars. So that was at a historical low level, around 10 or 12 in mid-2007. And spreads were very low. Our average LA5 spread was only 100. Of course, the crisis came. It could have been worse. But the point is that as recently as mid-April, spreads were back to very, very low levels. Now the question is, does what happened since about the end of middle April, this last segment here, does that undermine the case? Well, obviously, spreads have gone up. But they're still, for our more strong countries, they're still around this 200 level mark. And keep in mind, that's just the spread. What about the overall borrowing cost? Where is the U.S. 10-year bond, which is important in your output regressions we saw from our IDB colleagues? Well, here's the answer. What's happened since we use this as sort of, whoa, I'm okay. We use April 26th as sort of right before Europe, the turbulence really picked up, the VIX went up. What happened, you see, is that the U.S. 10-year bond, its yield went down substantially. And therefore, even though our country's spreads increased in the last 6 or 7 weeks, again, this is our favorite LA5, our strongest group, their borrowing cost is essentially stable. No loss at all from that point of view. And in fact, if we had just the last few days, we'd be down even more. So this is still what we call easy external financing conditions, and that poses some challenges. Good news, of course, but just like high commodity prices are good news for most of our countries, it poses a lot of management challenges. Now, I don't have much time. I'll just say, if you have a chance to look at our report, and I did bring a couple copies in Spanish and English. It's also available on our website for free. If you look at it, you'll see that we basically look at the region in four analytical groups that are defined mainly, not geographically, but by their exposure to certain kinds of shocks. So the more financially integrated countries are one group. Actually, that's a subdivision of the countries that are commodity exporters. Then within the group of countries that are net commodity importers, we have those that are tourism intensive and those that aren't. Well, it turns out that those external conditions, consistent with the message from the IDB, turn out to explain a lot in our region about risks and recent output performance. And I won't have time to go into it, but I'll just say that you can see the differences here in the growth picture across our four groups of countries. So here you see that the countries were affected differently in terms of output. This is output in 2009, with the tourism-intensive countries doing the worst. But they also have quite a bit of a difference for 2010. Here we have the commodity exporting financially integrated countries, the ones I was just emphasizing on the left on the blue bar, doing the best. And I have to say that when the new IMF forecasts are released in the first week of July, those numbers will be higher than they were. So we'll have, instead of nearly 5%, it'll be over 5% for that group. And I think you know why, is that the latest data going back to Q1 and also first quarter and also some monthly data since then for countries, especially such as Brazil, are coming in very strong. So the growth outlook varies widely. within that group, it's important to mention that Brazil and Mexico, I guess, are at different, quite different cyclical positions. So where we have Brazil, Peru, and Uruguay sort of closer to overheating than anybody else, Mexico is quite a bit below potential. Back to our group of, this is the financially integrated groups highlighted in this map. They're back to this challenge of managing good times. And what we pointed out, basically the theme of our Rio and where I'll stop today, is just what are the policy challenges when you've got easy external financing, good conditions, and high commodity prices. Well, to look at that, we did quite a bit of analysis that I'll just show summarized in these two charts. There's not time to go into the detail, but the point is that we focus on how domestic demand in our countries responds to these situations. So it's a little different from the idea that, well, capital flows come in, they change the exchange rate, that hurts exporters, et cetera. That story has some validity, but what we really want to emphasize is how in our countries domestic demand seems to be very sensitive to external financing conditions. We split that into two parts. The VIX is a proxy essentially for their spreads, for the borrowing cost that's attributable to their spreads, and into what we call the international real interest rate. And what we're trying to do here is to show in both cases that our country's domestic demand responds positively when either the VIX, the borrowing cost, goes down, the spread goes down, or the international real interest rate goes down. Since we define the shocks as things going down, you see positive numbers here. So the point is the blue bars are showing how our countries react in terms of domestic demand growth faster than their output growth, faster than their trend growth, how they react to those conditions compared to control group. Now, just to do something different here, we've got the control group being not a bunch of Eastern European emerging markets, but we've got Australia, Canada, New Zealand, and Norway. These countries share a couple things. They share being commodity exporters as an important part of their economies and their exchange rate determination. And they have inflation targeting, very flexible exchange rate regimes to go along with that. Well, so do our countries to a degree that's varied over time. We have to estimate these responses using a long sample period that includes times when our countries were not as flexible in their exchange rate policy as they have been in recent years. And we think that's one of the key reasons why our countries seem to have their domestic demand be so sensitive to these easy external financing conditions. There are other reasons that probably have to do with liquidity constraints, many structural reasons, also the fiscal policy response, which is another variable that gets controlled for, among other factors we just won't go into today. So there's a number of reasons, but one of our key candidates is we're still key suspects, is that we still don't see our countries taking a sort of a symmetric approach to exchange rate flexibility when they have times of capital inflows, or what we prefer to call easy external financing conditions. The policies that we want to emphasize, I think, to respond to manage these conditions may sound kind of standard, but we have a few twists. They're similar to the ones that were outlined in your report. But the thing I'll close with is to say that we really feel that the ability of a floating exchange rate, of letting the exchange rate appreciate, especially in the early stages of capital inflows, when the exchange rate might be close to where people think is a sort of a normal level, but really letting it flexibly appreciate without trying to lean against the wind or manage it. We think that there's a big value to that in preventing credit booms, overheating of demand, inflation, bubbles, all those bad things. We think there's a big value to that flexibility, and we think it's underestimated or underappreciated. It's often overlooked, and that countries can sort of shoot themselves in the foot by jumping in too early to things like sterilized foreign exchange market intervention. Of course, we also see a role for the monetary fiscal policy mix. Especially, it's fairly easy to right now to argue, as our colleagues in IDB did, that having just come off massive fiscal or very large fiscal stimulus policies in 2009, the very natural thing to start with for our countries is to reverse those stimulus policies on the fiscal side first. That'll help a lot with the capital inflows problem, and it'll also help credibility. If you announce a temporary fiscal stimulus, it's important to remind people that it really is temporary. Then the other hot area is a macroprudential regulation, and I think Nicolas will be speaking about that and some other global issues, but really creatively looking at financial regulation and recognizing that a floating exchange rate, fiscal tightening, all the standard prescriptions are not going to give you perfect results. They're not going to be satisfied with it, and it's going to be even if they did, it's going to be important to look at the financial system as it always is. The last area is, well, what about capital controls? What about sterilized foreign exchange market intervention? Well, I mentioned both of those together because, in a way, they're sort of things you might try when everything else has already been tried to the limit that you can do it. So it's easy to say tighten fiscal policy, but perhaps you can't go as far as you'd like. It's easy to say be flexible with the exchange rate. Perhaps you've already let it move, appreciate very flexibly to a range that everyone thinks is overshot, and yet still some crazy carry traders are not scared off by the appreciation that's gone on so far. Well, certainly the IMF has taken a view to be very open to the idea of capital controls, and basically the spirit, I think, is that it's worth a try. We all know their limitations. We're not sure they're going to work, but we're certainly not sure they're not going to work. On the other hand, what everybody seems to want to go to first is sterilized foreign exchange market intervention to fight the appreciation. And even that we can't say we rule out, but we really caution countries against taking that as the very first approach to sort of prematurely jumping into that area. Of course, it does have the advantage of accumulating some reserves, and reserves are good for sudden stops, for resilience, et cetera. But we really don't think that the best way to accumulate reserves, the best way to establish a good external liquidity position, is by leaning against the wind in an ad hoc way, responding to capital inflows. It may happen, but that's not the best way to do it. Nicolas?
Well, thank you very much, Steve. Well, since everything that is sort of solid economics and solid economic reasoning has already been said, I'm going to enjoy the luxury of going to science fiction. First of all, I couldn't agree more with the IDB report in stressing the importance of external conditions. Well, we have known that in the region through the stop and go for a while. Actually, it's very, very important. And the importance of the lender of last resort, it's just music to my ears. It's not that just Guillermo. I mean, a lot of people, I remember my old times as the director in the fund, together with Stan Fisher, tried to convince the fundamentalists of the moral hazard thing to do the CCL without success at all. It took really a major, major crisis to move them out of their comfortable seats. And now some of them are receiving the hard treatment of volatile capital flows, they are even more inclined to understand that there are things like innocent bystanders. So I fully agree, and I very much appreciate what you did, guys, in terms of providing a solid empirical basis to show that did make a difference. Of course, we cannot, being IMF, forget that domestic policies matter a lot. And when Ernesto was talking and I said that smoking was irrelevant, was just a joke because I'm a heavy smoker. But Steve emphasized, we really detect a lot of a difference in terms of the resilience of the countries depending on how solid domestic policies are. I remember vividly being Minister of Finance of Chile when Argentina was falling apart and markets were getting crazy about Latin America because they feared Lula, and the spreads were 1,600 basis points. And we in Chile did have sort of very solid fundamentals, and we never were really put under question. So even without lender of last resort at that time. So domestic policies matter a lot. But are necessary conditions, not sufficient conditions. And we have dramatically come to that conclusion, even for the more sort of advanced economies, like the European one. Now, That's the good part. What I'm not so sure I would pick the same alternative scenario as the IDB people did, because we do not particularly see that there is a major probability of China decelerating. All our information is that they have still a wall of money and ample ability to relocate money from the tradable sector to the non-tradable sector, from private to public. So we don't think that they're going to hit the wall anytime soon. There's no evidence of that. So a deceleration of China is not really a tail risk that we see as something very probable. Furthermore, you seem to believe that there is this can be a bit politically incorrect, but more of a sort of a linkage, trade linkage between what China is doing and the U.S. economy. Our research models do not suggest that. This is not to say that what happens in China and the level of exchange rate in China and the savings rate in China is irrelevant for the U.S. and net exports and all that, but it's not of first order of importance. What really matters is what consumers do in this country, and that's very much to what I'm going to go to, that is financial conditions. What really drives this economy, U.S. economy, is financial conditions. So we have a composite for that, and that's what we have to look at very carefully. They have been improving systematically, but have deteriorated a bit after the European thing. So that's the crucial variable to watch. In other words, what my alternative scenario would be, rather than a China slowdown, would be to what extent what's going on in Europe is going to be short-lived or not short-lived, but more important than that, whether it's going to have spillovers to the rest of the world and to this economy in particular or not. That's sort of what they call, we will have a decoupling, like Europe living its own saga and the rest of the world living happily thereafter, or we'll have more contagion. And some remarks on this. Trade linkages between Europe and the U.S. And trade linkages between China and the U.S. are not that big. Not that big. And given the improvement in the underlying financial conditions, we are looking to a solid growth in the U.S. of around 3% for this year and the next one. What remains to be seen is to what extent, if the European thing really gets out of hand, we can have financial contagion. And we can have financial contagion basically through two channels. One is that the degree of risk aversion goes up. So the relaxation of the lending conditions here, I'm talking corporate bonds, small and medium enterprises, all the credit channel could be affected. And that's one important thing. But the other one is that the connections between the European financial system and the American financial system may be more important than we know. And the administration has put forward a number of reforms that are in Congress now, and we hope after those reforms are passed, probably the next crisis we won't be in the situation we are now. But the fact of the matter is that we do not know for sure how important is in the credit process in this country the presence of European banks. So if really we have a hell in Europe and a lot of deleveraging, we have been looking a bit to what would happen if Spanish banks do have a lot of funding problems, and what would happen to Mexico or Brazil because of BBVA and Santander. But there are also big European banks in this country, and the substitution is not immediate. But there is another aspect of this that, given the regulatory parameter, we do not know for sure, that is the exposure of the U.S. financial system to Europe. We know the bulk of it, but we do not have all of it, especially the exposure through OTC, because that was not within the regulatory framework. So I guess the key variable to watch is, where is this financial thing going to stop? Now, four closing but important remarks. Sort of error type one kind of thing. We have seen clearly that as the situation of Europe has worsened, some other markets have benefited. Because to some extent, this is, as the ADB people were saying, this is a matter of distribution of liquidity. So if some agents get more liquidity squeezed, necessarily for the given level of liquidity, some others are going to get less liquidity squeezed. So we'll have more space. So one error, and I am IMF, so you could say this guy's going bananas, an error would be everybody rushing to the exit door in terms of fiscal consolidation, because it's just a fallacy of composition. Not everybody can get squeezed, liquidity squeezed at the same time. I mean, in an environment of VIX going up, people is not going to run to stocks. Are they going to run to gold? It's too tiny, too small a market. To land, transaction costs. So you have seen T10 are going down 80 basis points. So the ones that have fiscal space should not run to the exit door. That would be a mistake. Moreover, because if everybody's too conservative in terms of fiscal policy, the weight over monetary policy to avoid a double dip would increase. And the more you use monetary policy in the countries that are sluggish to get out of the cycle, the more you are going to flood the countries like Switzerland, but also Brazil and also Peru and also Indonesia, and the problems that Steve was talking about, the difficulties of absorbing too much liquidity when you have a sort of better fundamentals for the time being, it are sometimes unsurmountable. So that's not a cooperative world. Okay, that's one. I'm not saying by that, 2 minutes. I'm not saying by that that the ones that already received the wake-up call from the markets in terms of fiscal space should not begin to do it yesterday. Of course. As fast as they can. But the ones that are not receiving that wake-up call, and quite the contrary, that have been benefited, should not rush to the exit door. I guess I have no... We are, okay. This administration in the U.S. is pretty much in the same page, so I have no further elaboration on that. Okay. What else? We have basic problems of, let's say, coordination. What's going on really in Europe these days that is dangerous? It's not just sovereign risk. The thing is that given the lack of a good sort of comprehensive regulatory perimeter and authority, markets do not know which banks really do have the toxic paper. So the sovereign constraints are transforming themselves into liquidity constraints for banks, and the credit process is getting impaired. So we desperately need that Europe does a stress test like the one that was done in this country. Why is not that done yet? Because in this country, the stress tests we're doing, but public money was provided to ensure that if you would find a big hole in this or this or this bank, public money was going to replenish those holes, because if not, you just create a panic. That's not going on in Europe, because there's no such a thing as that pool of funds, but these are in the making. So coordination is not just the lender of last resort. It's sometimes the ability to have funds that could be sort of displaced from this country to this country to fill the holes and to avoid a contagion. I guess, given that I have 2 minutes, whatever, are we making enough progress? Oh, this will take me 10 minutes. So I won't do, I guess for us Latin Americans, it would be very important to keep very close the discussion in this country and others about regulatory reform. There's no doubt that legislation in Congress is making a deal of a progress in terms of correcting blind spots, expanding the regulatory perimeter, and requiring skin in the game to align the originators' incentives in the right direction. But I guess the crucial test would be to ask ourselves, if those reforms were in place, would still we be comfortable in terms of being sure that a mess in Europe would not spill over into a financial problem in the U.S.? We have to see. Evil is in the details here, but as we are seeing in this new world that is before us, the speed, the unpredictability of financial contagion, given the sometimes unsurmountable problems of information asymmetry in the financial system, is really calling for another level of coordination at the world level, including through the lender of last resort, but sometimes also having some more sort of fiscal funds that can be moved around to avoid sort of corner solutions where liquidity gets too much shifted away, say, from Spain or others, and too much into Switzerland or Mexico or Brazil. Or final, if you want me to make sort of a guesstimate, I do not think that the alternative scenario is one where we Latin Americans are going to be liquidity squeezed, or China would sort of decelerate, so commodity markets are not going to be that great. I think that the name of the game in the coming years is going to be how, for the first time in our lives, are we going to cope with better fundamentals and with extraordinarily positive financial conditions and commodity prices without developing a full-blown, a complete bubble, and afterwards a full-blown crisis. And conventional policies, fiscal, monetary, and exchange rate, as Steve was highlighting, are badly needed, but the realm of prudential regulations is something that we have to explore much more. New Zealanders, others are doing a lot of things in that regard. And I guess the research agenda should be heavily concentrated in those issues going forward. Thank you.
So I'd like to ask the other presenters to come up, and we have just 10 minutes for questions before turning to the next panel. So Ernesto, Alejandro, Steve, would you mind coming up here? We have time for just a few questions. Maybe what we can do is collect a couple and then let the respective speakers take the relevant questions. So the gentleman right there, if you wouldn't mind standing up and also just identifying yourself, that would be helpful.
My name is Courtney Blackman. My name is Courtney Blackman, and I was the governor of the Central Bank of Barbados from 72 to 80 to 87. I forgot now. such a long time ago. All during, through most of the, as a matter of fact, after the 80s, when we had the counter-revolution against the Keynes, which was spearheaded by Reagan and Mrs. Thatcher, the IMF effectively pursued the market fundamentalism, that paradigm. Since we have two members from the IMF, senior members here, can I ask you now, has the IMF accepted that that paradigm has failed, and what steps are they taking to reconstruct it or replace it, or are we going to pretend that it's still working?
I'd like to collect a couple questions, if we could, and then we'll give the members of the panel a chance to respond.
Eduardo González Mora, Georgetown University. I have a question, maybe it's Mr. Alejandro. You mentioned, I read just a few days interview with former President Bachelet, and she mentioned that one of the success of her during her term was this fund of the copper that allowed Chile to move forward in the stimulus plan. I would like to have a more explanation. I didn't understand very well if how effective really this kind of funds are or were in the crisis, and also if you take in account in the methodology this kind of specific conditions of some countries. Thank you.
Why don't we take one more? There's a lady right there.
Hi, my name is Raj, and I'm a PhD student and currently an intern at the IMF. I have a question for IDB. So basically, as you said, liquidity management or reserve accumulation is something that the countries should consider going forward. But if I've read correctly, that during this crisis, a lot of Latin American countries did not use the reserves. Instead, they actually let the exchange rate take care of itself, and there was not much utilization of the entire stock of reserves that were accumulated over the last 5 years. And secondly, the swap lines that were provided by the Fed Reserve were also not used as much as maybe by South Korea. So in that sense, how would that fit into the discussion? That would be my question. Thank you.
Okay, last question there.
Good morning. My name is Mr. Lloyd. I'm from the University of Maryland. Do you have any investments or any in Latin American country have heavy investments on human resource development? Because in times of crisis, when all things fail, such as machinery, money, and everything, people would still matter the most. So how much are the Latin American countries investing on human resource development? Thank you.
Okay. I think what we'll do is just I'd like to give each of the presenters a chance to respond to any of the questions that are relevant and also to each other's reports. But please remember we really have to start the next panel in the next 10 minutes, so be brief. Want to start with Ernesto?
Okay. Let me start by just simply addressing two or three points this question of how to make consistent the fact that you may want to accumulate reserves and at the same time promote a more flexible exchange rate, although the promotion for the flexible exchange rate is more on the IMF side. No, basically we share part of the many times these reserves were not used for exchange rate purposes. I mean, but in terms of in periods of extreme illiquidity, they were used as a mechanism to provide direct credit to, for example, exporters when trade credit dried up. So the simple answer is they might be put to uses that are non-orthodox and not necessarily related to intervention in the foreign exchange markets. Now, as international arrangements are perfected, and access to an international liquidity of, lender of last resort is made available, then the need to accumulate reserves in principle should diminish as long as you have predictable access to those other resources. I just want to make only one more comment just to give my room. I totally agree with Nicolas fully that the greatest challenge for Latin America is today how to cope with initial conditions that are fundamentally sound together with very high commodity prices and more importantly, massive inflows of capital. We live in a very strange world. This is the most likely outcome if the European crisis in at some point doesn't go astray. And if you look at Europe as a collective entity, there should be nothing that should prevent the ECB and the European Union from solving this crisis without entering into panic. But the problem is that this is a looser federation of nation states, not of states, and something can go wrong, as you said, Nicolas, in the coordination. So, two comments. One, I don't think that the problem is very complex from the banking point of view, in the sense that these are plain vanilla sovereign bond holding. These are not very sophisticated instrument and easy measurable, and the impact on the balance sheet of the banks is pretty easy to estimate. So I think we have a huge problem, fiscal problem in some countries in Europe that is not going to be resolved without a bailout. That's the bottom line. And whether implicit or explicit, implicit through ECB purchases of bonds of the countries that have problems. But so if everything goes right and no coordination failures put us into panic mode, then I think that the scenario of a capital flow abundance is going to be the one we will have to deal with. And the only concern I would put forth in the table is that when we analyze the policies of individual countries, and this may be relevant for smaller countries, we analyze them from the country perspective, but we are not taking a global perspective on the matter. Let's assume, just for the sake of argument, that capital controls work perfectly and that you prevent capital from flowing into the country. Then, in a world where you have deleveraging in the private sector of the industrialized world, fiscal consolidation, I mean, it would be natural for that excess liquidity to flow into emerging economies, and that they would be collaborating in the global adjustment by reallocating demand from the industrial world into the developing world. Now, if we block the system by preventing this capital from, let's say, successfully entering into the countries, then we would be contributing to a world recession or a world depression. So systemically relevant countries such as China should bear part of the brunt of reallocating world demand towards emerging economies.
Alejandro, please be brief, because we're really running out of time.
Okay, as brief as I can. So I'll tackle three questions. First, the one about the copper fund. I mean, I couldn't agree more. A couple of years ago, we produced a report that we called All That Glitters May Not Be Gold for Latin America, and we were making exactly the point that external factors were so good in the region. We had very high commodity prices, very low interest rates, and growth in the industrialized world, that the region was growing faster than its long-term growth rate, but pretty much due to such strong external factors. And the Chileans took that seriously, and they made the savings that were necessary during the good times to fight the crisis that came later on, and let them even do expansionary and quite expansionary fiscal policies with no credibility problems whatsoever. Regarding the human resource development question, multilaterals are aware of that, and I can give you a precise example about the IDB. The IDB was lending $7 billion before the crisis, and it increased its envelope to about $11 billion just to keep those long-term programs afloat, even at the height of the crisis. And I had a quick response to Stephen's remark about the use of credit ratings. It's a very valid question. I just wanted to mention that there is, even though I'm not going to defend credit rating agencies here, let me just say that there's a strong correlation between those ratings and variables that we typically use as fundamentals, as current account deficits, fiscal positions, and so on. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Nicolas?
10 seconds. I agree that to some extent the countries with a better position do have to absorb part of the, sort of the world savings, as Ernesto was saying, and China among them. That's why Steve said, what is our line, that do not begin to counteract exchange rate appreciation too soon, on top, because it's counterproductive, because that creates carry trade and other things. But you cannot, and I'm sure you agree with me, ask is the emerging world to do all the work, because we're just going to drown, you know, and the realm of politically feasible degrees of maneuvering within fiscal and monetary and exchange rate may not suffice. So you will have a non-cooperative world with a lot of trade restrictions, capital restrictions. So as we need a less lender of last resort for emerging markets to avoid too much liquidity squeeze, maybe we need some kind of fiscal plus lender of last resort for advanced economies that cannot get out of the woods and try to over-rely on easy monetary conditions to get out.
Thank you. Steve?
Really quickly on the IMF's market fundamentalism and whether we've I'd like to focus on whether we've changed over the years, but just interesting because what we're advising right now, let's take Keynesian economics. If you looked at what the IMF was advising last year for advanced economies and for many developing economies, it was basically a textbook from 1932 or 1933. I mean, very large fiscal stimulus. Was the IMF always doing that? Not so much. But what was different was that many of the countries for whom we might have liked to have recommended it, it just wasn't realistic. They didn't have the financing possibilities. They had incredible fiscal policies and serious fiscal solvency problems. It just the shot wasn't on the board. Financial regulation, I think over the years the IMF has very continuously realized even more the importance of that. If there was a time when the IMF's idea of financial regulation was just to liberalize interest rates and say everything will be fine after there's only one market interest rate, that time has been long gone, and all the efforts that the IMF is leading or participating in right now to basically tighten, and you can call it many different things, but it all ends up in tightening financial regulation, really shows that there's no market fundamentalism. Everybody agrees that the financial markets are fundamentally imperfect for information asymmetry reasons, just for starters. Capital controls is an area where, again, the IMF has extremely open mind. And finally, the big area where the IMF's changed, was emphasized by the IDB, the recognition that providing that there's international coordination problems that deserve huge liquidity responses for countries that have good fundamentals. Maybe the IMF was slow to come up with that, but one thing that's different is that the number of countries with good fundamentals that can really benefit from this kind of thing has increased over the years, too. So I'd say the IMF has changed along with the world.
So a good news panel. First of all, I'd like to thank all of our presenters for wonderful presentations and, I'd say, fairly optimistic view of a possibly choppy future. But so thank you very much. And then I'd like to ask Guillermo Calvo, Nancy Lee, and Mauricio Cárdenas to come up. We're going to have a panel discussion in the last half hour.
So I'll keep my introductions brief. I think we're going to start with you about 6 minutes, something like that. So Guillermo Calvo is professor of economics and international and public affairs and director of the program in economic policy management at Columbia University. He has a very distinguished trajectory beyond that, but I'm, for the sake of time, just going to keep these introductions brief. Nancy Lee is Deputy Assistant Secretary for the Western Hemisphere at the Department of Treasury. And Mauricio Cárdenas is Senior Fellow and Director of our Latin America Initiative here. Again, all of them have much longer and much more distinguished backgrounds than I can speak to now, but I'd rather give them time to speak. So with that, we'll turn over to Guillermo, and if you could keep your remarks to about 6 minutes each.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation. This has been a lot of fun. I've been making notes, and I'll probably be very confused trying to read them. So I guess we open up many, many key issues here that go beyond the Latin American experience. And I think it's worth starting reminding us that we are looking at the crisis where the financial market has not been working properly. In fact, it's the source of the problem. And economists had not been trained about thinking in those terms. Those that study macroeconomics normally, the financial sector is something that fundamentally works. It's not a source of big trouble. We always talked about the Great Depression, only to say that we don't know what happened there. So we are very confused now, too, but I think it's very important to keep our eyes on the financial issues, and I welcome very much the discussion that we just got from the presenters. Let me just say a few words about that. I think, obviously, there are these two factors about Latin America. They've done their homework. Number one, that's very clear. Also, they got Latin American emerging markets new support from, and very quickly, I was surprised, the G20, how quickly they reacted to this, because when you don't have a good theory, it's very hard to react in such a way. But they did. And actually, they started the foundations of mechanisms that look very much like a lender of last resort at the global level. So that's something very striking, I would say. Now, is that enough? I think Lehman is a very interesting episode because it shows to me, at least, that that was not enough. That the decoupling, we discuss a lot about the decoupling of emerging markets up to Lehman, but Lehman changed everything overnight, very quickly. And countries that you would not suspect that they were going to be hit so badly, they did. I mean, Chile is a stellar performer in Latin America from many angles. If you look at the sudden stop in domestic credit, was one of the largest in Latin America. When you think a little bit about it, then you realize that being integrated sometimes may be dangerous. I'm not saying that you should not be financially integrated, but in a world where the financial sector fails, you are at the eye of the storm all of a sudden. So I don't want to concentrate on or open up a discussion about Chile or Brazil, which also suffer from this. But just to indicate that, for me at least, the Lehman hiccup was very important. And the fact that they went out so quickly, I think, is because the lenders of last resort in the north came back to the to the fight. And very quickly, not only they said that they were going to give a very strong signal by bailing out AIG, that was not even a bank. So I think that's an indication that we live in a period where the financial sector is at the center, and that The other big issue, given that we don't have a lot of time, and I'd rather leave time for the others and questions and answers from the floor, but the other big issue that came up in the presentations, especially by Nicolas, is the concern of what to do with this excess liquidity that we have in some sectors of the global economy. And I think that is why the agreement that you want that excess liquidity to be rechanneled, and it's good news that it will be rechanneled to developing countries. We've always been talking about that. This is a chance, and I agree that if well administered in Latin America, it could give us a shot in the arm for several years. And so the question is how to do it. And I'm just coming from a meeting at the Latin American Regulatory Committee, and it's a shadow committee. And the concern, when you look at the details, is how you're going to implement it. Because if it's going to happen, then the current account is going to widen, and we know that the wide current account is very fertile ground for sudden stop. So, and countries are aware of that. So there is a tendency to stop the capital flow. So in that regard, I think an idea that we started floating is that maybe the multilateral institution, financial institutions have a role to play here, and maybe we should go a little further, not just and follow countries in the sense of, for example, the FCL, the flexible credit line, could be adjusted counter or procyclically, whatever you want to call it, by maybe giving support to countries so to facilitate the adjustment that it will have to take place. If the adjustment is big, it is very risky for individual countries to take it by themselves. They will have to perhaps accumulate lots of international reserves and make it very costly. So I think that's an idea that maybe we want to discuss. On I'll finish on a couple of things. Two, on the fiscal front for Latin America in particular, I think there's little room except for countries like Chile, as shown in the IDB several reports. But maybe we should think more deeply or go back to some of the issues that I remember we discussed when I was at IDB with the fund on PPP, private-public partnerships. It's very tricky, I know, but we seem to be moving to a regime now where the private sector is taking the back seat, and the public sector is borrowing and investing, perhaps taking a bigger role in that dimension. And I think maybe that's the way to go. Some of us may not like it, but that's better than not using savings, otherwise you fall into a Keynesian trap. So if that is going to be the case, then I see a role for institutions like the IDB and the World Bank to help out in countries to recycle those funds by procedures that are stable and hopefully free of corruption. And maybe we should think another issue that I remember when I was here that we discussed a lot is how to measure fiscal deficits. Should we include investment or not, for example? So if it is done, of course, we don't want – it's a very tricky issue because once you open the door, then everything becomes investment. We know that. But that's precisely why a very close collaboration between multilaterals and the countries that make those investments credible, bona fide investment, maybe that's something that we have to think more seriously now because the funds have to be rechanneled. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. This has really been an incredibly interesting discussion. I don't want to prolong it unduly. But so what I'll do is just focus on drawing out a little bit the question of what all this means for reform of the international financial institutions, the IMF on the one hand, and the multilateral development banks. And also, I just want to say a word about this question that is actually at the center of the G20 discussion right now, which is rebalancing global growth, which several have mentioned already. I am actually deeply grateful to Ernesto and Alejandro for doing their very careful empirical analysis, because I've actually been asserting what their conclusion has been for about a year now, that the role of the FCL and the other IMF reforms has been transformative in terms of the ability of this region to recover from the crisis. I had a much less sophisticated empirical analysis. Basically, I just looked at spreads, emerging market spreads, particularly for this region, and noticed that if you look at April 2009, particularly April 1, 2009, you see after Mexico announced its intention to seek an FCL, a steep drop in spreads, a very steep drop in spreads, after they had been sort of perking along at a fairly high level. And I think that is a real indication that markets thereafter viewed emerging market risk in a fundamentally different way, particularly emerging markets with sound policies. I think the combination of tripling the size of the financing capacity of the IMF plus the FCL plus its brother or sister facility called the HAPA, the High Access Precautionary Arrangement, basically created an insurance policy for countries with decent policies so that they didn't have to rely solely on self-insurance in the context of reserves. Let me just make two more points about this. First, this is a tool. These tools, these precautionary insurance tools, are particularly beneficial for this region. In fact, they have been taken up disproportionately by this region, because this region went into this crisis with smaller macroeconomic imbalances, lower debt levels, particularly external debt levels, and were not, at least this is not true of all the economies in the region, but for the LAC 5 that we've been talking about, they didn't need gap-filling finance. What they needed was precautionary finance. So I think these innovations have had a particular benefit for Latin America. Europe is really in a very difficult situation with respect to the need for IMF financing. The second point I'll make is that there was another thing that happened in April 2009, which I think received a whole lot less attention, which is part of the G20 announcement or communique in April. So let me just quote in case you missed this particular sentence in the G20 communique. In the context of the current crisis, consistent with the IMF's mandate, we back the case-by-case use of IMF resources to support the fiscal needs of countries with solid medium-term fiscal prospects. So the additional innovation and flexible element that's quite important is the fact that there is less now of a rigid line drawn between balance payments and budget finance in cases where there is basic fiscal sustainability and in cases where that line is pretty arbitrary. So far for this region, there has not been a large budgetary element to the finance provided by the IMF on either a precautionary or actual basis, but it certainly has, there has been a big budget component to the finance provided to Europe. And over time, it may well prove useful to countries in the region, maybe the smaller countries of the region, to have the capacity to use the IMF as a budget crisis response tool. That brings us swiftly to the role of the multilateral development banks, which are generally viewed as the providers of budget support. We very much supported a very aggressive and rapid ramping up of the financing from the World Bank and the IDB. By 2009, approvals had reached something like $14 or $15 billion for both institutions, up sharply from much lower levels prior to the crisis. A lot of that finance was investment finance, and the actual emergency response tools weren't really taken up very substantially by the countries of the region. So I don't think we view those institutions as very good at being lenders of last resort. We instead very much agree with the points in Ernesto's and Alejandro's paper that these banks are much more suited to the question of the long-term growth potential, the poverty reduction performance, the inequality reduction performance. And then what that also brings us to another very important study the IDB just released, which is on productivity in the region. It's called The Age of Productivity. I commend it to all of you. And it has some very useful estimates about productivity performance, and they're pretty disturbing for the most part. And in particular, the thing that I learned, which I had not really realized, is that productivity performance for Latin America in the services sector is lagging very substantially behind that of East Asia, for example. And in Latin America, as in other emerging markets, 60% of the labor force is employed in services. So this is a fundamental productivity issue. We just got finished with a long and sometimes intense set of negotiations on a capital increase for the IDB. Of course, the United States, with a large share of that institution, will furnish 30% of that 70% increase in capital. And I'm pleased that the reforms that we agreed on in that process, and particularly the priorities that we set, map pretty closely with the kinds of issues that are identified in the IDB productivity report as critical issues. The very high transport costs of the region, which are impeding trade very dramatically, much more substantially than trade barriers at this point, the education innovation issues, the lack of access to finance, particularly for small businesses. So we're very intent on seeing those reforms go forward. One final point. This is actually a region which began recovering in 2009 in a fairly balanced way. The initial spur to recovery in the major countries of Latin America was domestic demand. It was actually not net exports. I think Mexico is an important exception to that. So it is, in fact, showing the growth in domestic demand that we need to see in the global economy in order to sustain recovery. As you know, there is a conversation happening now in the G20 about this question of how to sustain recovery, how to strengthen it. And there is, of course, a strong view among a number of countries that the surplus countries have to play their role, and I think this was mentioned by Nicolas and I think Ernesto, in terms of creating enough domestic demand to help sustain the recovery. So I think this region has a very strong stake in that discussion, in this question of a kind of global collective action to ensure that there is enough domestic demand, and particularly from countries that are surplus countries. We cannot have the U.S. continue to be the consumer of last resort for the world, although, as Nicholas said, our economy is mostly led by consumption trends. So this is something where I think the United States and other countries in the region share a strong interest with respect to the rest of the world. Thanks.
Thank you, Carol. Well, it's been really great to read these two reports. As I was saying in the introduction, the two reports are really complementary in a way, and are also, you know, great input for our own discussion and debate on the economic outlook of Latin America. And we could go, you know, on and on for hours and speak about them and all the details and the topics that they cover. But let me focus on a few of them in these 6 minutes and try to make some comments. I think these two reports essentially deal with three types of questions. One is explaining what happened
like right before and after the Lehman crisis. Two, explaining what's happening today. And three, discussing how to prepare for the future. I see the IDB report a little bit more focused on the initial question, why did some countries in the region respond better to the global crisis than others, with a very compelling response, which is the difference is whether you have access or not to an international lender of last resort. I think that's a very interesting answer. It is a very important conclusion. It does give a lot of support to the idea of improving the facilities that we have today. It puts the center and the focus of attention here in Washington and in the multilaterals. But it is important also to discuss a little bit more how Ernesto and Alejandro reached that conclusion, because I think that's not the only answer that has been given so far. It is a very good answer. It's a good approach, but there are other potential explanations. One is what Steve mentioned in his comments, which is whether differences in the fundamentals went beyond differences in the credit ratings, which is their control variable, whether there were other aspects. There was a question in the audience about destabilization funds, for example, and I think those issues are very important, and they were not necessarily captured by the credit ratings. Another explanation, which I actually heard here at Brookings the other day by Olivier Blanchard and co-authors, is that really the countries that handled the crisis better were the countries that had less short-term external debt. That it was not a matter of how much your trading partners were growing. It was not much about how much reserves you had accumulated. It was basically the old type of explanation that it's how much you needed to roll over in terms of your debt. And I think that's another competing explanation, which is quite interesting. So I think in the refining, because I'm sure this is not going to be the only paper by the co-authors and by, you know, people in the profession about this topic, in refining this explanation, I think we have to in some way make sure that we put this hypothesis to compete with other potential explanations and make sure that at the end of the day we get the conclusion that it's the international lender of last resort, once we also control for these other potential explanations. Now, one interesting aspect about the international lender of last resort is that in the way they have it in their paper, it's a dummy variable on whether you had access or not. Think of a regression where the dependent variable is what happens with your spreads 60 days after the Lehman crisis, and the explanatory variables are your initial ratings plus this dummy on whether you had a lender of last resort or not. And that dummy takes a value of 1, not just in the case of the countries that where resources were made available by the IMF through the different lines, especially the FCL, not just the countries that had access to the swap lines from the U.S. Federal Reserve, but also countries that had access to swap agreements with central banks, like the Central Bank of China. So, for example, Argentina, which had access to a central bank line from the Bank of China, would have a value of 1 in that dummy dummy variable. So, one I guess interesting extension of this work is to see whether it matters who is this lender of last resort, whether there are differences in credibility. I think that will have an impact also in terms of the way we design these things in the future, and whether the IMF plays a differentiated role, say, relative to other providers of resources and liquidity. So that's one question regarding the conclusion, which I agree it's a very compelling explanation and a very interesting one. Now, On explaining what's happening today, which was more like the focus of the presentation that that Steve made, I'd say that these are confusing times, and I think it's a difficult time for economic authorities in the countries, in the region, because on the one hand, the keywords are, we have overheating in Latin America. Our economies, or many of the economies in the region, are growing above potential. There are some inflationary pressures. So, you know, it is, of course, there is some pressure for responding to that overheating, and that's what we're seeing today with the central banks raising interest rates. So now the game in terms of the analysts that follow the region is who's predicting by how much the central banks are going to increase interest rates and how fast. You know, we've seen increases in interest rates in Brazil, in Mexico, in Chile, and Peru. There are other countries that will follow, and I think in the next meetings of the boards of the central banks we'll see more of that. But at the same time, we have these overheating and inflationary pressures. We have a debate in the world about the possibility of a double dip and the possibility that the crisis in Europe creates another bump, and that at the end of the day we go into a new recession. And I think to add to the complexity of these of the current situation, there are risks in China. I tend to agree with what Nicolas said, which is basically a more optimistic view of China, that they still have a lot of firepower to respond in the event of a deceleration. But at the end of the day, China is not immune to lack of growth in the international market. China's, we all hear about the possibility of a bubble and the need to curb credit expansion. So, you know, it's not a certain thing that China will continue to grow at 10%. So it's a complex and difficult situation. Now, what to do in that context? I would say that there are two ways of going. One is essentially what the governments in the region are doing, which is basically phasing out fiscal stimulus and basically reversing monetary expansion, so that the countries are ready for a basically in a position that if it's needed in the future, they can implement a new set of countercyclical policies. But also, it is true that there is a concrete and very direct expression of all these of this environment, which is the pressure towards the appreciation of the currencies, and the response of the governments to that situation it's something that will be very important from the point of view of future economic growth. And I see in that aspect, in that area, along with the point that was made by Nancy at the very end, the need in the region to, as has already been done by the governor of the Central Bank of Brazil, to join forces with the U.S., in terms of putting pressure on China on exchange rate issues, because it's the problem with the appreciation of the currencies in Latin America, it's not that they're appreciating. I mean, when you have such an amount of capital inflows coming, it's only natural. But the problem is that the currencies of Latin America are appreciating, whereas the Chinese renminbi is not appreciating. So that to me means that there is the need for more coordinated action, and of course the natural place to do that is the upcoming G20 meetings, where the countries of Latin America should take a stronger position on these together with the U.S. Treasury. And finally, let me just mention, I was thinking in bringing today, but I guess the format is not the best to do that. We'll do it some other time. We've been constructing here at Brookings some indexes of recoveries. Some of them were already published for the G20 countries in the Financial Times, but we're doing it for the LAC 7, the largest seven economies of Latin America, basically the idea is to look at the principal components of the key real sector, financial sector, and confidence variables to build an index of recovery for each one of these economies and for the region as a whole. And based on the movements between these variables, the variables include basically the usual suspects like industrial production, exports, imports, GDP growth, the consumer and the business confidence surveys, the stock prices, the market capitalization, the MB spreads, all those variables that basically shape economic fluctuations. And what we're getting from those principal components is that the economies in the region left basically the crisis behind. That's one thing that is already well known. But that there is a lot of differentiation between the countries in the region. And that if you had questions a year ago on the usefulness of this classification that the IMF has on countries in the region between the primary exporters, the ones that are financially integrated, the ones that are not financially integrated, the primary importers, the ones that depend on tourism, those differentiations were not that clear about a year ago when countries were in the middle of the recession. Now it seems that there is a lot of differentiation. I mean, I wouldn't call them the primary exporters are not financially integrated. It's basically Venezuela and Argentina that are not doing well, and they're not doing well for reasons that perhaps not only have to do with the degree of financial integration. They have to do with issues related to the protection of property rights, the governance issues. But we're seeing a lot of differentiation. That's one aspect. And the other aspect is that within all these components of these real sector, financial sector, confidence measures, the one where the recovery has been the fastest and where you're already back at the levels where you were at the previous peak, it's in the financial sector variables. It's in the area of stock prices, market capitalization, MB spreads, the variables that are in that area. So that to me, and with this I'll conclude, to me suggests that this current expansion and the overheating we're seeing is pretty much led by financial variables, and that is always a source of concern. That only should be a source of concern because we know how fast these things can change and how easy we have the reversals. Something worse happens in Europe, and therefore these countries have to be able to respond to a changing conditions very, very fast. That's why I insist in the point of creating more fiscal space and of course, monetary space as well to be able to respond in the future to a changing conditions. And let me just, and I'll finish, I promise I'll finish with this last remark. Let me take a point that also was made by Nancy, which is at the end of the day, what is remarkable about Latin America is not that Latin America is growing again, that it was able to respond well to these crises, the recent crisis, but what I think is even more remarkable is how low the potential GDP growth is. That once you start growing at a rate which is above 4 or 4.5%, you start seeing all these pressures, so you need to start, you know, stepping on the brakes to make sure to cool down the economy. So we have to worry more about potential GDP growth. We have to worry more about investment. We have to worry more about making sure that we capitalize this current economic context to basically move forward in terms of reducing some of these structural constraints on economic growth. And that, to me, is very related to the question of increasing investment rates and allowing these countries to run slightly higher current account deficits and therefore accumulating a little bit less of international reserves in the next round of the World Cup. Yeah, I'll finish there. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much to our panelists. We're already over time, so if we've got one or possibly two questions, and I'll give a last sentence to each of the panelists. And if not, I think we may have tired everybody out. Does anyone on the panel want to respond to anything else, or Guillermo?
I don't know if it is a response. It's a plea. Stop budging China. China has increased. The fiscal stimulus in China is the largest by far. The exchange rate in China, what do you want to do with that? I mean, the competitiveness in certain sectors, in order to balance that, the exchange rate will have to take a big change. There are all kinds of problems. It's an economy with sticky wages. I think it's very dangerous. I don't think the exchange rate is the key to solve financial or global imbalances. The U.S. is already on its way to solve the balance if they were to balance their fiscal accounts. The private sector has a current account surplus of almost 4% or around 4% of GDP. So if you stop the fiscal deficit, you can right away revert the conditions. So I sympathize a lot with what you're saying, because from the point of view of Latin America, it's something that really hurts. But when you look at the big picture, I mean, they've been doing their homework for us on policy. One issue that I think we touched, but I would emphasize, is that we had to think very seriously in Latin America now whether we want to pursue inflation targeting with one interest rate, just looking at inflation. Should we also be concerned of monetary aggregate? Is credit is something that we have to put an eye on? Should we follow anti-cyclical credit policy? Those issues, which was not for this panel to answer, but I think that I will put that on the table. And finally, the issue of floating exchange rates that has become here in Washington something that you say and everybody seems to agree. It's like when you go to church and there are certain things that everybody sitting there does not question. And now we are not questioning floating exchange rate. So how come the Fed is giving this enormous currency swap to the ECB? If the exchange rate does the work, why do you need to give dollars to the ECB? Lots of dollars. I understand that you give dollars to Brazil for the sudden stop problem. Was it because of the sudden stop? I doubt it. So floating exchange rates, I don't disagree with the idea, but obviously I think we are finding limitations to that, and there could be excessive floating where the financial issues that we have been discussing could get worse. And in Latin America, they can't make the situation worse, especially for countries that have liability dollarization, and we know that. So I'm not against it, but let's tone it down. Thank you.
Mauricio, have 130 seconds.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more on the idea of the general equilibrium consideration on the exchange rate of the renminbi. Yes, I think there are, you know, many ways, many things you have to do, many things that have to happen to restore global balances, which are not just a change in the exchange rate. So my comment was more on like the partial equilibrium, if you want, with regard to Latin America, which is when you look at the sectors that are growing in Latin America, interestingly, are mining, or you know, basically natural resources. And in some countries, construction manufacturing is not growing very fast, except for a couple of countries, particularly Mexico. And I was just reading one of the reports put by the banks in New York about Mexico and about the region. And the interesting thing is that Mexico's manufacturing output is growing very fast because of exports of manufacturers, and exports of manufacturers are growing because Mexico not only increased its exports to the U.S., and restore its market share in the U.S., but it's because Mexico is taking some of the market share that Germany had, Spain had in the U.S., and I think this is related to changes in the exchange rate. So in a way, the issue of the Chinese exchange rate is important in that limited context. That's why I think it's of interest for the region to join forces, not because I think that that would be a solution to global imbalances, in which I agree with Guillermo.
Yeah, take a sentence.
Oh, sorry, it's going to be three sentences. Okay, I was focused with respect to global rebalancing. I was focused on domestic demand. I didn't use the word exchange rate, actually. And the issue now is to prevent what happened prior to the crisis reoccurring, and there is a finite risk of that, which is if surplus countries, if the balance of their growth is shifted too far to export-led growth, we would see the same kinds of patterns reemerge. We know the globe has to adjust because the U.S. has to adjust. So there has to be more of a balance between domestic demand and export-led growth in surplus countries. I think China is moving in that direction. But I think that's a good thing that they're moving in that direction, because it's really critical. With respect to the swap with the ECB, I would just refer back to the points that Nicolas was making about with respect to the European financial system. There is a need for access to dollar liquidity, and there are some risks there, and I think it's prudent for that swap facility to be in place. Thanks.
So we're concluding with a little more debate than we started, but that's, I think, the sign of a good session. Thank you to all our panelists for both sessions, and particularly now to this last panel. And all to be continued as we watch the next stages in the international economy unfold. Thank you for coming.